Welcome to the Thomistic Institute podcast. Our mission is to promote the Catholic intellectual tradition in the university, the church, and the wider public square. The lectures on this podcast are organized by university students at Thomistic Institute chapters around the world. To learn more and to attend these events, visit us at thomisticinstitute.org.
The Thomistic Institute is a really incredible ministry. It's like a full-service catering corporation. Students get together. They determine among themselves what they'd like to hear about. And by the generosity of the donors, Thomistic Institute, friars are sent and ragtag professors with them to discourse about what it is you want to hear about. And so when I was asked to come here, I wanted to know, what do you want to talk about? What do you want to hear about? And I was shocked by the response. I heard that you wanted to hear about the truth. You know, that's exceedingly and increasingly common these days, to want to hear the truth. You know that many of your peers want to hear anything except the truth. They want to hear what is useful. They want to hear about what is pleasant. They want to hear about what will promote their interests. They want to hear, as St. Paul alludes, things that will soothe itching ears, ears that are always desirous of hearing things that are new, that are wondrous, that are bizarre, rather than things that are established, healthy, that put us in touch, that rectify our relationship with God and ourselves and one another. So far we've been talking about the truth about God, the truth about us, the truth about our place in the world, our capacity to know the truth. We have talked about the splendor of truth. It's radiating, illuminating qualities. I want to switch gears now and talk about the truth, but truthfulness, which is to say the moral virtue by which we make the truth manifest in our lives. The title of my talk comes from the book of Ephesians, where St. Paul exhorts one of the first congregations in Ephesus, and by extension us, to speak the truth in love. And it's a good day to begin thinking about these issues, because we are indeed surrounded by a great cloud of witnesses, not least Saints John Fisher and St. Thomas More. Many of you, I'm sure, know that St. Thomas More was a lawyer and a devoted father, that he quickly rose to the highest political post, the Chancellor of England. Some of you may know that Fisher was a preacher and a scholar, who as a bishop gave himself unwaveringly to his flock. You may know that Henry had both of these men publicly executed in the summer of 1535. You may know that before the axe fell, Thomas More declared himself the king's good servant, but God's first. Now there is the manifestation of the truth in love. It's an exemplary instance of the virtue that we'll be describing according to the mind of St. Thomas Aquinas. Everything I say to you in what follows, I hope, will make plain to you the fruit of my own study of the questions on truthfulness and its opposing vices in the second part of the Summa. Okay? And what we're going to do is talk about two big, think of the first talk as consisting of two buckets. The first bucket is everything that we can say in the time we have about what a moral virtue is. The second bucket pertains to the virtue of truthfulness itself. Okay, but I want to begin approaching this topic by first establishing some things about what it means to call something a moral virtue. Okay? So we're going to talk about moral virtue, we're going to talk about truthfulness, and then in the second talk, we're going to talk about some of the vices that stand in opposition to truthfulness. And the hope here is that we bring into sharper focus today the beauty, praiseworthiness of truth-telling and the difficulties and dangers that stand in its way. Okay, so what's a moral virtue? Moral virtue, let me see your eyes. This doesn't make sense. We'll pause. Moral virtue is a habitual disposition. It's a way of being inclined toward a certain kind of activity. It's a good habitual disposition in this twofold sense, that it makes a person good, worthy of praise, and makes their action good. It's a capacity that you can exercise at will that enables you to perform some good act when one ought and in the manner one ought. To say that a virtue is a moral virtue, moreover, means that it has to do with, broadly speaking, human action and or passion or feeling. So when we begin talking about moral virtues, we're talking about the virtues that qualify, that perfect, that complete, that make whole and stable the desiring part of the soul. Okay? The Latinate transliteration of Thomas's language we might call it the appetitive part of the soul, but that's a hard way of saying it, isn't it? Someone earlier this week was talking to me about Plato. Okay, when we're talking about moral virtue, we're talking about the desiring part of the soul, either the spirited part, right, the irascible part, the part that has to do with fending off danger, with enduring difficulty, or the part, on the other hand, that has to do with the pursuit of goods, goods that are pleasurable, goods that are wholesome, goods that are useful. Okay? So, what a moral virtue is a capacity that perfects, directs, and stabilizes some desiring aspect of your person. It consists, moreover, in what Thomas calls a kind of mean, or medium, or midpoint. In the Latin, it's medium, and we sometimes render that as a mean. I'm going to refer to this medium as both a mean and a midpoint, all right? And you'll see why in a bit. I'm going to dwell on this topic for a little bit. This last point about moral virtue consisting in some kind of medium or mean, all right? What's that mean? Well, a little illustration here. Suppose I have here, well, I have a clipboard. But let's imagine that this clipboard is a ruler or a measure by which I would measure other things. If I'm going to cut a piece of cloth, a piece of paper, if I cut it too short, the paper falls short of its measure, right? Let's do the measure this way. Here, the paper falls short of its measure. If I cut the paper too long, it exceeds its rule or measure. If, on the other hand, I cut the paper and make it equal to its measure, I've established a kind of relationship between the rule or measure and the thing measured. Here's the rule, here's the thing measured. I've adjusted them so that this is brought into conformity with this. And the reason I'm dwelling on this is because, according to Thomas, all of the moral virtues have to do with bringing our desires, our actions, our feeling, our affection, our passion into conformity with their rule, their measure. This is true in every moral virtue, insofar as every moral virtue has to do with action, feeling, speech, conduct, in the most general sense. So the question now is, what is the rule of moral virtue? What do you think?
Reason.
The rule of moral virtue is indeed reason, which is a proximate measure, however, because as we've been discussing and as is evident in our ordinary experience, reason itself needs to be measured. So the proximate measure of a moral virtue, the thing that we bring our conduct into conformity with, is the judgment of reason. But the judgment of reason will itself be duly measured insofar as it conforms with eternal law, God's own judgments about the good and the best. The eternal law, insofar as it's manifest in the natural law, insofar as it can be discerned through the work of prudence and other intellectual virtues, insofar as it is declared for us, it's made manifest to us in divine law, which is to say, in the inspired word of Holy Scripture. So, the proximate measure, reason. Reason gets measured. How do you know if judgments are accord with, your judgments accord with the truth? Those judgments will have to themselves be subjected to, brought into conformity with divine reason or eternal law. Let's get some examples. Because as we go on, if we begin talking here in generalities about reason as such, we're going to lose track of the very particular kind of thing that each of the moral virtues is. So let me give you a couple of examples. All right, so the first and simplest is temperance. Okay, temperance is a moral virtue. It's about pleasures, principle. It's about the pleasures of the table and the bedroom. Because these, as far as I'm aware, I'm sure you'll agree, are the things that most vehemently elicit our desire. Temperance is about the pleasures of the bedroom and the table. Let's talk about pleasures of the table, food and drink. You bring your desire for food and drink into conformity with reason insofar as you those desires become rectified, stably inclined toward a very particular judgment that reason arrives at, and that is, in the most general terms, that one should act, one should eat and drink only as much as is conducive to the health of the body. So, think back to our rule, our measure. To be habitually inclined to eat more than is good for the body consists in some kind of gluttony, let's say. On the other hand, to be habitually disposed to eat less than is good for you, good for your body, will amount to some kind of disordered eating. So, on the one hand, you have an excess. On the other hand, you have a deficiency. What temperance is the moral virtue that establishes a kind of equality between the judgment of reason and desire, and by extension, the consumption of food and drink indexed to desire. Yeah? Slightly more complicated example. Fortitude. Fortitude in its parts. So there's fortitude, or courage, the virtue that has to do with enduring and contending with dangers of death. And then there are a whole host of virtues that resemble fortitude in some way, insofar as they deal with the endurance or the attacking or the pursuit of difficult and dangerous goods that are slightly less difficult or more or less difficult than the most difficult and dangerous thing, which is contending with dangers of death. Think of St. Thomas More. Okay. So think of fortitude, for example. What's the rule of fortitude? The rule of fortitude, like every moral virtue, is reason. But Thomas thinks there's a particular judgment that will come under this big, broad category of the rule of reason that will, in every instance, measure our pursuit of difficult and dangerous goods. What's the rule of fortitude? Can you think of it? To begin thinking about the rule of fortitude, you have to begin asking about excess and deficiency in matters of difficulty and danger. So according to Thomas, the rule of fortitude is that one should neither attempt to endure or to overcome dangers that are beyond one's power to endure and overcome. So think of the foolhardy, rash, impulsive young man who runs at every dangerous thing, 100 miles an hour, throws himself into difficult situations, quite apart from whether he has the capacity to endure those situations or overcome them. This is a kind of excess. It resembles fortitude, right? The man who runs at a grizzly bear may look courageous, but let's say he's not. Contrarywise, someone who runs, who flees, who avoids some danger that is actually within their power to overcome, exhibits a kind of cowardice. We begin to see here that all of the moral virtues have a lot to do with a right estimation of the world, of one's circumstances, and oneself in relationship to those circumstances. Okay? Think about another part of fortitude we might call magnanimity, or in Thomas's earlier works, he refers to it as a kind of confidence. This is the part of fortitude that has to do with the pursuit of difficult goods that ordinarily would cause us or tempt us to a kind of despair. Saw this fellow here writing his dissertation thesis last night. It was about 9:45. And 9:45 on a Wednesday night, you know, maybe that's the time to write a thesis. I mean, I've certainly tried. But you know, this is a difficult thing, the completion of a thesis. And at every turn, midway through every chapter, you'll be tempted to give up, to think, what's the point? I can't do this. It requires a kind of confidence, a kind of sturdiness of soul to contend with things that are difficult. And what we need in life is a moral virtue that strikes a midpoint between the foolhardy pursuit of things beyond our capacity and a kind of despairing smallness of soul that shrinks from the things that we're actually capable of. Now, all this is, of course, radically transformed when we begin to think about agency in light of the gospel, in light of our being children of God, dwelt by the Holy Spirit, to whom the promises of heaven are given, insofar as we're infused with faith, hope, love, the gifts of the Holy Spirit. What I can do on my own, what you can do on your own, is one thing. It's quite another thing to ask what we can do, right, insofar as we are cooperators with God. We can set that aside. Here's another one, justice. Justice is the moral virtue that pertains to human relationships and to exterior goods like honor, wealth, with material, artificial things like honor. Did I already say honor? Yes, I did. Honor, wealth, that's money, material objects, shelter, transportation, just things that we clamor for unnecessarily. Justice has to do with the rectification of human relationships insofar as those relationships are mediated very often by one or more kinds of exterior good. It's the virtue by which you are inclined to give others their due. So in justice,
the rule or measure is going to be what? Well, it depends on what we're talking about. If we're talking about justice in the exchange of goods, if you take a candy bar from the basket, you are obliged to pay whatever the little sign says you're obliged to pay. And to pay more than you're obliged to pay would be exceeding what justice requires, which may or may not be an act of vice, okay? But to pay less, or to pay nothing at all, is to fall short of what justice requires. Think about honor. Human beings are owed a certain kind of respect just in virtue of being human beings. We know this. We know it especially when we feel as though we are denied the recognition that we're due. Justice, insofar as it pertains to our friendships and our various relationships, even with political strangers, has to do with rendering to others, and especially those who are not connected to us by blood or in other kinds of intimacy, has to do with giving others their due. And this is, and it's just here that we come to the habit, the virtue of truthfulness. Because truthfulness, according to Thomas, is part of justice. Before we get there, I'm just going to pause to see if you have some questions. Let's just recap. One, a virtue, a moral virtue, is it's a habitual disposition that makes a person and their work good. It pertains to the rectification, the adequation of some matter to some rule established by reason. It enables you to act in a way that conforms with reason's judgments about the good and the best according to the circumstances in which your various actions and desires and feelings are nested. Questions? Yeah?
And obviously we hold saints as examples of virtue. So do you think the virtues that they uphold, the seeming excesses, where would they be coming from?
Yeah, that's a good question. I thought we were going to press it a bit further. You know, there's a body of literature in contemporary analytic philosophy having to do with moral sainthood. And a good deal of this literature, well, basically contends that moral sainthood turns out to look rather vicious and isn't necessarily something to be pursued, okay? What you're adverting to is a distinction that I've been so far leading to the side in Thomas's thinking about the difference between the acquired or natural virtues on the one hand and the infused or supernatural virtues on the other. The acquired virtues, the virtues that Aristotle speaks of, that I've been talking about in the most general terms as a heuristic, have for their rule the judgments of human reason, insofar as human reason can arrive at those on its own, without the help of grace, apart from divine revelation. Okay. So the rule of temperance for the acquired virtues will be roughly, as I've suggested, that one neither eat nor drink, in terms of quantity, more or less than is beneficial for the health of the body. The rule of infused temperance, on the other hand, has a different, what Thomas calls, aspect or ratio, a different vantage from which it looks upon the same matter, the same things, both the pleasures of the table in the bedroom and the desires pertained. And that rule, or that aspect from which it looks upon those things, is not simply the health of the body. It's the castigation or the subjection of the body to God. So think of St. Paul, right? I castigate my body. I subject it, okay, to to the Lord, that I might be an instrument for the preaching of the gospel. Okay? There is a, here, it's a, the rule, the divine rule, the aspect from which these matters are judged is not contrary to natural reason, but it may exceed, the rule of, the divine rule may exceed while comprehending the natural rule. And yes, we'll say that insofar as, say, St. Thomas More, St. John Fisher, they contend with the most difficult things, right? Dangers of death, the impending, unavoidable threat of the loss of life, loss, the obliteration of the experience of life. Yeah, okay. They are empowered to do this, we think, we believe, we confess, by the Holy Spirit. Yeah, so not just the virtue of fortitude, but the gift of fortitude.
You said that the measure of temperance regarding food is the good of the health, not gluttony, not. And I just wonder, how does this fit into our like culinary experience with like good restaurants where we eat food for like good things, like good food for good pleasure. I just want to experience good food. So where I don't see necessarily the good of the health of my body, so I nourish myself properly, but I want to go to an expensive restaurant to enjoy this good steak.
Right. Yeah. Well, I think that insofar as you are a creature of God, put on this earth to cultivate and to make much of God's gifts, seems to me that the health of the body will involve a certain degree of pleasure. Yeah. So the temperate person is not a kind of austere, necessarily an austere, insensitive, just like I'm thinking of Wittgenstein. Wittgenstein used to say, I don't care what I eat as long as it's the same thing every day. Okay. I don't mean to cast judgment on Wittgenstein. He was actually an incredible person. But it belongs to the health of the body, which as we discussed on the first day of these talks, really can't be held firmly separate from the health of the soul, insofar as we are body-soul composites. The health of the human being has to do with a certain degree of pleasure. But when pleasure runs toward excess, I mean, it very often results in both spiritual and physical sickness. In the back, and then, yes?
I was wondering, to what extent in your discussion was about the role that sort of natural reaction takes, so fight or flight, freeze dynamic.
Yeah, so he's entirely aware of this phenomenon. It can't be denied, can it? There's an adage, I don't know if it originates with Seneca, but it's associated with Seneca in the medieval mind. Something along the lines of, you know, if you encounter a tiger in the forest, you better have brought, you know, a change of clothes, a change of pants. When a tiger roars, okay, there's an inaudible frequency that rattles your bones. Okay? You are not made with claws and fur and teeth. You are not a 250-pound jungle cat. It belongs to human nature, I'm willing to say, by necessity, that the sound of a tiger that you're, you know, in the jungle, you know, is going to, you know, the teeth are going to chatter. You may lose your lunch. There will be a moment of pure physiological response. Okay? Thomas thinks of these as, well, he'll call them pro-passions or impulses. Okay? So there's a certain domain of human life that just, on account of our animality, is going to, you know, respond in a certain way. The question is, then, how are we going to relate to those movements of body that kind of have a an independence from our judgments of reason, right? But there are certain aspects of human life, of human existence, that can't be brought under the control of reason. You know, you have some degree of control of your respiratory function, but probably not your digestive function. Thank God that you don't have to just sort of deliberate and think about, oh, I gotta digest. One second, right? You know, a good deal of our existence is autonomic. So, two-part question, or two different questions. One, an acquired virtue cannot become an infused virtue. Because a virtue is a habit, and a habit is a kind of form, and forms are numerically distinct. Think about the difference between 4 and 4.1. If I add a tenth, a numerical unit, to 4, I don't have something, I don't have 4.1, or I don't have 4 anymore, I have 4.1. These are distinct numbers. Habits are forms, and forms are like this. So the habit of acquired virtue is something distinct from habit of infused virtue. Infused temperance is not acquired temperance. The infused virtues are given with grace, okay, which God pours into us, into the very essence of the soul. This is good news. The very core of your existence is suffused with God's own saving goodness toward you. And from that big, bold, divine yes that says, I make you new, there flows into the powers of the soul the infused virtues, the first among which are faith, hope, and charity. Charity is the love poured into our hearts, St. Paul says in Romans 5, by which we are made capable of loving God and others in God. And from those, from faith, formed, suffused with charity, hope, formed, suffused with charity, okay, the other infused virtues flow. And not just those, what Thomas calls the gifts of the Holy Spirit. And so charity is not a moral virtue, okay? And the reason for this is because it has, well, it's twofold. Well, but we'll focus on just the one point. That's the most essential. It's that the object of charity is not some rectification of human action or just, okay? Its object is God. So the theological virtues all have in common that they have God as their object. Yep. Truthfulness. So to talk about truthfulness as a moral virtue, you have to talk about truth. We've been talking about truth, but let me give you a quick flyover of the conceptual content of veritas, truth, as we call it. I'm going to get my handy little illustration back out. So, truth, according to Thomas, is kind of a quality in two senses. It is the equality, first of all, that obtains between the mind. Let's say this is the mind and reality. So, if you were to say, Brother Idol, your shirt is not wrinkled, I would say that judgment falls short of the truth, because indeed it is embarrassing. Here we have the adequation, the equality, the mutual adjustment of two things, right? So the judgment of the mind will be true insofar as it is brought into conformity with what is, okay? Secondly, and derivatively, and here we're approaching the matter of truthfulness, your speech, your conduct, your comportment, your way of carrying yourself will be true insofar as you make what is the case with respect to yourself manifest in speech and action, so that your speech, your action is equal to the truth about you. Okay? Now, if I tell you that, it's just the most mundane example, but if I say, I have not been on a Big Ten Preaching Revival Roadshow for the last what, 10 days? False. I have. Okay? So too, if I were to go, now it hasn't been 10 days, so this is a great example, because although I haven't aimed at something less than the truth, I have just now inadvertently told you something that exceeds the truth. It's not probably been quite 10 days. So when we talk about truth, we talk about the conformity of the human mind to reality. When we talk about truthfulness, we talk about the conformity of human speech and conduct to the judgments of the mind, the truth of which will, of course, have to be measured by their conformity to God's own judgments about the good and the best. So there are intellectual virtues besides truthfulness, okay, thinking of virtues of wisdom, knowledge, understanding, prudence, that have to do with the conformity of the mind to reality. But when we're talking about truthfulness as a moral virtue, we're talking about, rather, the conformity of, in the big, broad Augustinian sense, signa, signs, outward gestures, manifestations, speech, okay? Conformity of all this to human judgment. Brassitas, truthfulness pertains to the quality of the sign and the thing signified. Specifically, it consists of the manifestation of the truth concerning oneself. Truth about who you are, truth about what you've done, truth about what you know, the truth about what you believe, the truth about what you cannot deny. Like all the moral virtues, it consists in a kind of adjustment or a kind of equality of rule and reason. But in the case of truthfulness, this is the case in a twofold sense. First, truthfulness has to do with the exterior expression of the truth about oneself, as one understands it. Okay? But secondly, it has to do with the expression of truth in the circumstances that warrant or permit that expression. Okay? So think of it like this. When we're talking about any of the virtues, and this goes for any of the virtues that we've been discussing up until now, we have to first identify the act of a virtue in abstraction, in its genus, as the kind of thing it is, right? So the act of fortitude will be to contend with, to endure, principally, and to contend with, to attack, to face up to some difficulty and danger, all right? But one has to do this in the right circumstances. Circumstances are the conditions that surround the act, and they're ready to hand. It's the who, the what, the where, the why, the when, the how, the what, by what means of human action. Let me say something more about this. If you're a priest, it may or may not be part of truthfulness for you to publicize your sin to your flock. If you are a singer in a choir, it probably, it very probably is not due that you would express your fascination with protein synthesis or recombinant DNA when the conductor is working with the tenor section, right? You just begin blurting out some just amazing fact about all these things. True stuff. It's true that what you say is true, and your enthusiasm for the subject matter is true, but this is not the time or place to make these things manifest. When you're angry, or when the person that you are disputing is angry, it may or may not be the right time to say the thing that if your disputant will only just see, will at last bring them into alignment with your own view of the matter. If you're at a funeral, right, this is not the time to begin discussing your calloused feet. You see where I'm going. It's good in and of itself to speak the truth about oneself, to attest to what one knows, to what one sees, to what one has heard, to what one believes. But in order for this action to be done as a virtuous person would do it, it has to be accompanied by a few circumstances. Who, what, when, where, why, and how. And all of this is going to come into sharper focus in the next talk when we talk about the vices opposed to truthfulness. Those vices being on the one hand, well, there are lies, lots of different kinds of lies. Little lies, big lies, harmful lies, innocuous lies, all being lies, nevertheless. These are the least, in my view, for today's talk, the least interesting and least pertinent kinds of deficient or excessive vices in relationship to truthfulness. It's, on the one hand, what I'm interested in talking to you about is the vice, on the one hand, of boasting, of seeking to make, to manifest some truth about oneself or some claim about oneself, whether through speech or conduct, which is not in fact true. Kind of, it usually springs from pride, but it's in itself distinct from pride. It's has to do with an excessive relationship to the truth. And then, even more interestingly, and I think, is what Thomas calls irony. Okay? Irony is the exterior denial or diminution of oneself in relationship to others. Okay? Maybe the humble brag is going to show up as a species of irony. We'll talk all about that this afternoon, but what I want to do just very briefly is just underscore in what sense truthfulness is part of justice. So justice, we said, is the moral virtue by which we're inclined within ourselves to render others their due. And according to St. Thomas, truthfulness belongs to justice. It participates in it insofar as we owe it. We actually owe it to one another to speak truly. We owe it to one another to make manifest in our conduct, in our dress even, in our general comportment, the way we carry ourselves. Owe all these. We owe it to others that our conduct conforms with the truth as we understand it. Yeah? So you might begin to think that something like irony, the denial of the goods, the virtues and the skills and the various gifts that you've been given would be a sin merely against one's own person. But in fact, first and foremost, it is, and we'll see why, I think, in the next talk, an injustice towards our fellow human beings. And you might have some questions about that, but I think we're probably at the point where we need to take some questions. So we'll stop there for now.
Thanks for listening to this lecture on the Thomistic Institute podcast. The generosity of people like you makes this podcast possible. If you enjoy these talks, please consider showing your support at www.thomisticinstitute.org/donate. Your donation of even a dollar helps us reach more college students and many others with the powerful truths of the faith, and it ensures that we can keep publishing top-notch lectures on this podcast. Thanks a lot.